Welcome to Living the Quantum Dream with your host, Cynthia Sue Larson, inviting you to explore ideas about how you can enjoy a better way of life from one of today's top experts in quantum consciousness. Cynthia Sue Larson is a life coach and the best-selling author of Quantum Jumps, Reality Shifts, High Energy Money, and Aura Healing Meditations, who has been publishing the free monthly Reality Shifters e-zine since 1999 through realityshifters.com. Living the Quantum Dream with Cynthia Sue Larson is part of Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age, heard Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on the Dream Vision 7 Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Cynthia Sue Larson, and our guest today is Dr. Larry Dossey. Dr. Larry Dossey is an internal medicine physician, former chief of staff of Medical City Dallas Hospital, and former co-chairman of the panel on Mind-Body Interventions, National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, National Institutes of Health. He is executive editor of the peer-reviewed journal Explore, the Journal of Science and Healing. He is the author of 12 books on the role of consciousness and spirituality in health, which have been translated into languages around the world. His most recent book is One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of a Greater Consciousness and Why It Matters. He lectures around the world, and I am honored to welcome him to our show. I've been consistently inspired by his books and writing because I so appreciate his wonderful skill at discussing some of the seemingly least down-to-earth topics in the most down-to-earth way. Welcome, Larry.
Well, it's just great to be with you, Cynthia. I really appreciate the invitation. I'm looking forward to our chat.
Oh, thank you. I'd love to start off by getting an idea of just finding out, in simple terms, what you know for sure that many people don't seem aware of that has the power to improve our lives. If you were just sitting down with someone who doesn't even know what we're talking about, might be, you know, Aunt Bessie or something, and she's just wondering, like, what's this all about? Just to make it the simplest, and we'll get more into it, but just for a starting spot.
Great. Well, what this all about is about for me is essentially the theme of my latest book, One Mind. I'm convinced beyond any reasonable doubt that our minds are not isolated to our brains and our bodies, or even to the present moment. I'm convinced that our consciousness extends beyond who we are as individual persons to include probably every sentient creature on Earth. I think this may sound a bit strange to people who bump into this concept for the first time, but if you pay attention to research that is emerging in what I call the field of consciousness studies, the only rational conclusion, I think, is that our consciousness is broader and deeper than any of us were ever taught in our educational experiences. And I think, furthermore, that our future on Earth probably depends upon the degree to which we can live into this and understand this in the heart, because I think our future as a species is contingent on whether this becomes real for us or not.
Now, that's a big jump right there. So I want to slow down, kind of back up a little bit. And I'm right there with you, but I just want to make sure we got Aunt Bessie with us too. So that big jump from connecting everything and saving the world, and saving the world can just seem overwhelming. I think a lot of people feel kind of burned out on that whole topic. Not that they should be, but they just feel like, what can I do? I'm one person. There's too much going wrong.
Well, I think the idea that our consciousness extends beyond our individual person and what we call the self to include everybody else is a way out of this feeling of helplessness. I've often been in a situation myself where I think, you know, what difference can I make? I'm one among 7 billion people. What can I do? Well, if we could really understand and come to grips with this idea that consciousness is universal, that envelops all of us, then this is a very empowering position to take, because you realize that suddenly that you're not alone. You're connected with everyone who possesses what we call consciousness, and there are no boundaries between people where consciousness is concerned. So we suddenly realize that we are not in this alone. We're in it together. And I think this can make a tremendous difference in how we conceive our power to make a difference in our future.
Right. And it also sounds a bit scary. So I'm just being honest from the Aunt Bessie perspective, representing, you know, the indigenous First sure. Nations people. They say, who speaks for Coyote? And so I'm speaking for Aunt Bessie here. Who's yeah. just saying, like, yeah. like, wait a minute. That sounds scary if everybody knows what I'm thinking.
Well, that's true. I mean, people do seem a little nervous with this idea that their consciousness might be hooked up to that of everybody else. And also a lot of people seem to fear this idea of being swallowed up in a universal mind or a common consciousness. And they sort of think that they're going to just be, they'll disappear into a homogenized goo of undifferentiated consciousness. But I think this is a theoretical worry that doesn't have any place in reality. If you study the lives of people who have actually made this leap into this notion of a connectivity between people, they don't experience losing their sense of self and individuality. That is retained. What comes along with it is this complementary sense that although we do function as individuals in our daily existence, there's some greater perspective which is invigorating and which usually carries with it a sense of compassion and a sense of love and a sense of caring toward every other person on this earth. I think that the price we pay for this unremitting sense of individuality has been a great one. I think it has led to an epidemic on this planet of greed and selfishness. I think that this is one of the main threats that we face as a species regarding everything out there as the other, which is unconnected with us, to us. And I think our hope for the future is adding to this idea of individuality with a sense of commonality and unity and connectedness, as I've tried to describe in the book.
Yes, and I think you've done an outstanding job. There's such a sense of, as you're mentioning, this integrity that, you know, brings everything together, obviously, with one mind. And clearly, I just love the way you said in the chapter 4, this one mind is not an infinite blob. Because I think when people first hear this idea, one mind, you know, it could be many things. It could be scary or it could be, what is this? You know, it just sounds a little terrifying. But it had me chuckling.
Well, it can be.
Yeah.
But, you know, let me add this, if I may. People in their everyday experiences bump into this idea of unity and oneness. And I think that they just don't recognize that this is really where they have come to in these elevated experiences where they feel as if their being is interactive with that of everybody else. You know, most people who are listening to us will have had this experience of being in love. And in that wonderful, crazy domain, it's clear experientially that you're one with the beloved. I mean, you don't sense boundaries. You feel as if you're together in every sense of the word. Mothers experience the same sort of sense of unity with a newborn. There are certain situations in life where the boundaries between people just simply seem to dissolve. This certainly happens with this experience of the one mind. People have certain phrases which they use to describe these elevated experiences, epiphanies, if you will, where they seem to be one with everything. They use the term, I just felt that there were no divisions present. So this is not as strange as it may seem. And I think the last thing we need to worry about when we think about this this idea is that we're just going to be swallowed up in some undifferentiated blob. For people who have been there, yes. That just doesn't seem to be the case.
So this really gives people a sense that there is a way to relate to something that seems so ineffable, and that would be just the way we normally do when we care about our children, when we care about whoever that other is that we feel a sense of oneness with. And I think a lot of parents feel that way. Children sometimes feel that way with a sibling if they're a twin, or even if they're just close with their sibling. And, you know, there's just that sense that there is no division. So I love that way that you describe that.
Well, I might tack on to what you just said about this issue of twins. One of the reasons I became interested in this idea of the connectedness of consciousness between people is that I am an identical twin. And my twin brother, Gary, and I, from as far back as we remember, have had experiences of being together in consciousness and even sharing physical symptoms, even when we were far apart. This sounds weird to people, I know, but you would have to be a twin, perhaps, to appreciate this. But about 30% of identical twins describe these feelings of shared thoughts and emotions and even physical symptoms at a distance. And to compound my interest in this, I happen to be married to a twin.
Wow.
My wife. Yeah, I haven't been able to get away from this twin thing. My brother and I used to just call it twin stuff. We didn't know that it wasn't supposed to happen. And as a matter of fact, my wife's twin brother and she have shared these phenomena all of their life. So our household has been an interesting little twin laboratory for
I think a lot of people will appreciate that. And there are a lot of people who are twins or no twins. And so it seems like your life is perfectly set up for you to be doing what you're doing. You know, in addition, with your medical background, where I obviously you've had some amazing experiences with that as well, which probably led you into, I know it did because I've read your books, but it's quite extraordinary.
That's right.
Yes.
You know, I have been on the front lines, so to speak, of internal medicine, and most of my practice was spent in hospitals treating people in intensive care units and coronary care units and so on. And it's not uncommon to have people who have undergone a near-death experience describe this sense of overwhelming beauty and a sense of oneness and connectedness in a near-death experience. So I have had an opportunity up front to confront people who have had the experiences that I'm writing about.
That's just wonderful. And I also wanted to bring up the fact that you've got some amazing examples, a very strong short list at the beginning of your book, One Mind, where you present a very, what I thought was a brilliant case for describing what would we expect to find and witness if there was such a thing as one mind. What if that did exist? Mm-hmm. You know, what kind of things, what could we look for that would be representative of that sort of a situation? And so I was wondering, what do you find to be some of the most convincing examples? You don't have to go through the whole list, but just for you personally.
Well, I think one of the commonest experiences people have is actually sharing thoughts with someone else. You know, in the consciousness research literature, this is called telepathy or sometimes clairvoyance. But the essence is that even between people who are far off in terms of distance, people share thoughts and feelings and emotions, which just should not be possible unless we were connected at some level of consciousness. Surveys show that 80 to 90% of adult Americans say that they have had shared emotions like this. And so this is just a way of saying that this is not a rare thing. Skeptics want to say frequently that it is only people who are weak-minded and, you know, have a fantastic imagination who experience these things. The data shows something exactly the opposite. Psychological studies have shown that people who actually experience these shared distant feelings and thoughts are individuals who are at the peak level of mental health. These are not people who are neurotic and psychotic and so on. So I want people to be willing to claim this as a potential and as an experience that is shared by people who are extraordinarily sane, people who are well-balanced, and this is a way of repudiating a lot of the skeptical criticism about this field, where people just simply don't want to go there, and they want to condemn this as something that's experienced by people who are a little bit nutty.
Right, but there is such a strong basis that a lot of people feel when they're in nature, for example, of feeling a communion with the space, with the animals, with the plants. And you actually begin your book mentioning some of this, which I thought was wonderful, at the beginning of One Mind, where some extraordinary interactions that you had with animals took place.
You know, one of the premises in the book was that shared mind, this universal consciousness, this unification of thought and feeling, is not just something that's shared between human beings. It is shared with all of sentient life, including non-humans, animals, birds, and even plants, even. I had a tremendous experience when I was writing this chapter about communing with animals. I live on the slopes of foothills outside of Santa Fe, and this is a country that is a natural habitat for coyotes. The thing is, they're usually very shy creatures, but when I was writing about this communion between humans and animals, up to three coyotes would come and stand outside by the window to my office and stare at me.
That's wonderful.
I thought, this is pretty cool. I mean, here I am writing about this stuff, and they're coming and as if to check on, to make sure I get it right, and gave me a little psychological pat on the back, saying, you're going in the right direction with this, and the animals have come to cheer you on and affirm what you're doing. You know, this has never happened. Coyotes looking at me from outside my study window in the 20-something years that we have lived here. So it wasn't a common experience at all. It had never happened before. And then when I finished the chapter on the animals, they quit coming.
Wow, I just love
it. It was
that.
As if they had a job to do, and they did it, and they were apparently pretty pleased with what I'd written. And so their job done, they skedaddled, and they haven't come back since.
And you mentioned in your book, go ahead. I love it.
So people can make of that what they wish, but, you know, you could say that, well, that was just one of those funny coincidences. That was just a chance happening. I can't go there. It seemed packed with meaning and significance to me.
And in fact, there was an example that you give in this wonderful book, One Mind, about telling the bees, which I'd never heard of this until I read your book. But apparently there's an ancient custom of letting bees know when the beekeepers die. And then you tell an account of a cobbler. I guess he wasn't even exactly a beekeeper, but perhaps just close to nature. He's also a postman. And his family in Shropshire was telling the bees when he died. I'd love to know if you could tell a little bit of that story for our audience and also explain why you think it's necessary to take that time and trouble to communicate with animals like this.
Well, the lore comes out of Western Europe and the British Isles that when the beekeeper dies, the bees know about it through some way, and then they pick up and move the hive. But it even gets stranger than that. Bees have a way of showing up at the funeral of the departed beekeeper. And so in the book, I talk about one of these funeral services for one of these deceased beekeepers, where bees actually come in and swarm over his coffin and then depart. I just think that this is an amazing sort of animal story that is so difficult to explain away by chance that you really need to ask questions about meaning and significance of these sorts of things. These things are so common in interaction between humans and animals that I just think that something's going on here in terms of communication between humans and other life forms.
I found it interesting. You know, go ahead.
Yeah.
But
no,
I think
ahead.
It was fascinating that obviously the animals, the coyotes and the bees, they seem to appreciate that kind of care when humans actually take that moment to tell the coyotes, like, oh, I'm working on that chapter now, or tell the bees, you know, that the beloved beekeeper has passed away. So it seems like the animals, they're part of one mind too. They obviously know something has happened, yet at the same time, they really appreciate when humans take that little extra step, when we focus our mind in that way. So I'd love to know if you have any thoughts on why sometimes it's necessary to take the time and trouble to communicate when we do have one mind.
Well, I have had some experience with this. I happen to think that one of the ways of contacting or accessing this idea of the one mind is to spend more time in nature with animals and so on. And to this end, for the past 30 years, my wife Barbara and I have taken the time and the trouble, and it is a lot of trouble, to take several weeks off in the month of August and disappear into wilderness, backpacking or having horses to drop us off in remote areas up and down the Rocky Mountain chain. And then we would just simply stay in isolation in a tent and camp out and sort of come to a different kind of understanding about our role in the world. And I can guarantee you that if you're sleeping in a tent at 12,000 feet for 2 or 3 weeks, that is a great way to get your consciousness altered and to step out of the hectic pace of civilization and to make recontact with animals, birds, fish, and so on. And this has been such a stimulus for my wife and me over these many years that I can't imagine not doing this periodically. I think it's a step towards sanity. It makes it feel a lot less strange that you might be connected with the natural world if you do something like this. I know this is difficult to do for a lot of people, but there are substitute ways that you could come in contact with nature, if for no other simple method than just taking a walk in a park or the woods sometimes. I think this is really an important step in understanding our connection mind-wise with sentient life.
It's respecting that sentience that is there, it seems like to me. And so that's maybe part of communicating occasionally with more focus and, you know, helping. I think animals and nature provide a focus for humans to sort of, in an interesting way, sort of turn attention away from what we create and what we're making and bring it back to the connections and, you know, how we can relate to everything that is. So I love what you're saying.
This is really an issue, I think, in this electronic age we live in, where, you know, kids no longer go very often to camp in the summer. Their exposure to nature is usually on the Animal Channel and this sort of thing. And I just don't think that is very smart. And I think that we pay a huge price, because the more we're cut off from nature, I think the more isolated we sense as individuals, and the great connect, which I call it, simply fizzles. And we pay a price because of the way we denigrate nature and take a selfish attitude toward being in this world.
And thank you for mentioning that aspect, because you mentioned in your book, another section I loved had to do with Jacob Needleman talking with students in his class and noticing that they seem to all share a common problem, which I think ties in perfectly with what you're talking about right now, which was loneliness.
Well, and yes.
Yeah. And I think that's obviously something that doesn't happen if you're, well, I'll let you explain it better. You can do better than I can.
Well, I think it comes as a surprise to people in this digital age we live in to discover that so many people feel lonely. I mean, this is the most connected and wired chapter in human history. There are 6 billion smartphones on the earth today, almost one per person. And people have never been more linked up electronically than they are now. And it's absolutely paradoxical because studies show that the more time kids spend online, the lonelier they feel. And the psychologists who try to tease this apart and understand what is happening thinks it's because people are spending, they're substituting screen time for FaceTime. And so kids get into a vicious cycle here. The more time they spend linked up electronically in their own little private domains, the more they feel lonely. And so we think it's supposed to work the other way around, but it isn't. And I think it's time for a huge cultural reassessment of the price we're paying for spending so much time looking into a screen of one sort or another, instead of spending time in people's presence. And I think the contact with nature is part of what is going on here. We are cutting ourselves off not from one another, person to person, but we've cut ourselves off from the natural world as well. This does not bode well for the human race.
Right. Well, hopefully it's just a little brief moment in time and like a blip. We can, you know, like a hula hoop phrase or something. Let's hope so. Yeah, exactly. Because it is pretty serious. And one thing that you mentioned, getting back on the topic of this idea of mind beyond brain, you got a chapter on that. And you get into the idea of near-death experiences. We haven't spoken much about that. These are NDEs. And obviously, they've had a huge impact scientifically as we study those experiences and come to find out that our view of non-local consciousness actually has been colored by classical thinking. I think that's fascinating. So some people, for example, might assume thoughts are being transmitted because they don't really have that non-local vocabulary. And you mentioned that transmission comes from the Latin to send over or across. So can you suggest how we might best start changing the way we think about non-local connection and communication?
Well, first of all, I think people should not be scared of this word non-local. It just simply means not local. Something is non-local. It's not in a place. So if their mind is non-local, that suggests that it's not confined to specific point in space, such as their brain or body. And if it's non-local with respect to time, it's not fixed in the present moment. So I go to great length to explain or try to explain the implications and the importance of this non-local view of the mind. And if people are allergic to this idea of non-local, they can just substitute the word infinite for non-local. And that will pretty much give them a picture of what we're talking about. So I think that as a physician, the fact that we have just been obsessed in the history of the human race with a local view of consciousness, we're paying a huge price for it. It has led us to say that when the brain and the body die, since our consciousness is localized to the brain and body, with physical death, all of that goes away. We are totally annihilated at the moment of physical death. As long as we hang on to the idea that our consciousness is just fixed and localized up here, there's no reason to hold on to that idea. The reason is that we are deluged with data now showing that consciousness isn't localized or confined to the brain or body. It is spread through space, and it is what you and I are comfortable with calling non-local consciousness, infinite consciousness. Why is this important? Well, as a doctor, I happen to believe that the fear of annihilation with physical death has probably caused more pain and suffering in the history of the human race than all the physical diseases put together.
Oh, I believe you're right.
People are absolutely terrified.
They are.
And so what does this have to do with non-local consciousness? Well, if consciousness is infinite or non-local in space and time, then it's eternal and immortal. Infinitude in time is what we mean by being immortal. To hold on to the idea of non-local mind is really to come up with this idea of the soul, something that isn't born, doesn't die, couldn't die with the death of the body, even if it tried. So if we have evidence that the mind is non-local, we have it evidence for the soul. We have it evidenced for immortality and the notion that we do not die with the death of the body.
I feel this is such
we
an important
We see evidence
message.
For this.
Yes.
In near-death experiences, which you mentioned a moment ago. And I think the importance of near-death experiences is that this is just another way of looking at the way consciousness manifests non-locally. People can see on the other side. They recover from a near-death experience with the absolute certainty that things aren't over with the death of the body. I think this is a tremendous contribution.
Absolutely. And I've had a couple of extraordinarily synchronized situations or experiences in my life. So it doesn't take much to convince me of how these things work, because I've had some amazing experiences, including being at my grandmother's deathbed when I was not the contact person. She lived in another city, miles and hours away from my home. Just the odds of that happening. And it was all synchronized and coordinated and orchestrated months in advance. You know, a bookstore had called to confirm my appearance as an author at a book event, which I had no knowledge of. And, you know, as an author, you don't say no to a book event if you can make
right.
it. So that was supposed to be a confirmation, but for me, it was the first I'd heard. Anyway, the whole story unfolded like that. And I ended up exactly, like I said, being at my grandmother's side, just basically minutes after she'd passed away, which was quite convenient because my parents were in Europe and my sister was unavailable. So, but I really believe, and that's not the first time such a thing has happened. Amazing things have happened, if I think about it, a couple of other times, way beyond any odds or possibilities. That's what I mean by you don't need to pitch me very hard, because I'm like, yeah, I'm right there with you. I know that our consciousness is so much more than what the official people who want, they seem so desperate to hang on to a structured reality. They want to really grip onto that, but because I think they want a model for how things work is what it is. And mm-hmm. So what I'd love to do is you actually present a model for how some of this might work, which I thought was amazing. In that same chapter about the mind not being an infinite blob that had me laughing, you mentioned the psychologist Joseph Chilton Pierce and his notion that there are levels on which thoughts can, under very special conditions, interchange, and there are levels where they cannot. So this should give some people mm-hmm. a sense of peace and not panic them so much that people know what kind of underwear they're wearing or what have you, because that's, nobody needs to know that. So what we tend to know is the important stuff. But you present a really great model in this mysterious realm of it's using stem cells. And I don't know if you'd be willing to describe how that might work just briefly.
Mm-hmm. Well, the idea that you just mentioned, that in your experience with your dying grandmother, that this was just not a random chance happening. There was meaning and purpose between your experience and her passing. And so I think if you look at the pattern of these kinds of non-local experiences that people have, you see that they usually feel some sort of need. They are purposeful. They're just not random. And so I think you can make an analogy about how stem cells work in the body. You know, stem cells are produced in the body, and they can differentiate into any type of cell which is present in the body, but they don't just randomly differentiate into, you know, a skin cell or a heart cell or a brain cell. They differentiate according to the need of the individual body. You know, if you damage some cardiac cells by a myocardial infarction, then those stem cells will take the place of those dead cardiac cells. They don't turn into a cell in the intestinal tract or the skin. They go to where they're needed. And I think this is an effective model for explaining these non-local experiences, clairvoyance or telepathy or whatever we want to call them, that people experience in their daily lives. They're not silly, stupid things. They seem to have significance and meaning for the person who's experiencing them. And so they fulfill a need, a psychological need, an emotional, spiritual need, just as in that beautiful example you gave with your grandmother.
I love that. I love the way that you mentioned that this amazing role that stem cells play, which is almost magical. They're like the angels of the physical body. And it seems like there's some as yet unknown mechanism. I think that's what, when I say material realists love mechanisms, that's often been the kind of pleading question that I've received from my family members. They know I'm a little bit different. You know, they just want to know, well, what's the mechanism? Like, how did you end up at grandma's side? How the heck did that happen? Right. And that's just one of many things. So often, you know, they just ask me, what is the mechanism? And it's a little frustrating because we don't know.
We can go there.
Okay.
One of the reasons skeptics have had such a hard time with this stuff is because, as you say, there's no obvious mechanism that would even permit this sort of thing to happen. And so they'll say, as one skeptic did, you know, this is the sort of thing I wouldn't believe, even if it were true.
that's awesome.
An actual statement from a hard-headed.
Now, what kind of a skeptic is that? No, that's not the right kind of skeptic.
that's right. An ideologue. That's what that guy was.
All right.
So in the past few years, there have been mechanisms which have popped up in science, which I think can go a long way to help us understand how these things, these one-mind, non-local happenings occur. It has to do with a concept that which originated in the field of quantum physics called entanglement, which originally meant that separated subatomic particles were somehow entangled with one another. Even though they were far apart, they had this uncanny ability to correlate their behaviors and changes instantly, even though they were separate. And so this looks like voodoo. It looks like just sheer magic. But here's the point. This entanglement, this distant connectivity between these separated particles is mirrored in an uncanny, incredible degree in people. Now, it used to be said there was no correlation between what the particles are doing and what people do. This prohibition has been blown apart. It is now acknowledged that this entanglement phenomenon occurs within people and between people, as well as between separated distant particles. So if people want to go to the trouble of talking about a possible mechanism that explains how you and your grandmother may have been able to communicate at a distance, then it's there. And this idea of entanglement and non-local connectivity now is recognized to occur in biological life, not just subatomic, atomic particle life. So there are mechanisms there, Cynthia, and we ought not to be shy to point this out.
Actually, this is what this show is all about. You're hitting on my passion at the moment. This is living the quantum dream. You're on the right show. And what I love is the fact that we're seeing increasing evidence all the time within scientific realms of like quantum cosmology, quantum biology, and quantum information theory. All of those three groups of scientists will agree with me when I say, or a majority of them, let's put it that way, and the up-and-comers, let's definitely add that, what they would say is that the quantum logic and quantum physics is the dominant logic in this world. And so that's kind of on the edge right now. That's not what most scientists would say. Most of them would try to put quantum physics under the rug. You know, it's small, so sweep it where we can't see it. We don't want to take a look at that. And it's not just entanglement. So it's much more. You also mentioned in One Mind that all possibilities, all configurations of information appear to exist in potentia, all superimposed on one another, awaiting some prompt in order to transform into an actuality in our world of experience. And so I just love that because it, you know, in the quantum realm, you know, entanglement is definitely one of the qualities that we notice. And this superposition of states is another. And now, you know, I am aware that Aunt Bessie and the so-called skeptics might not be following us where we're going, but hang in there because that's what I love is talking to you because you understand that there are some wonderful studies that are coming out right now showing that this is not just a pipe dream and it's not just, you know, people having hallucinations or something, but there really is a growing body of evidence to suggest that all these things you're talking about are true.
Well, I think it's important for you to point that out. I I try to keep up with the emerging evidence from biology that we are connected at a distance. And just to make this real for people, I'll just briefly mention one of these experiments which confirmed this. And this came out of a laboratory in Milan, Italy, from a group of neurological researchers. What they did was to take two batches of human neurons, brain cells, if you will, and put one batch over here and another batch over here, and they isolated them in containers which forbid any kind of mechanical or neural or any other kind of electromagnetic interaction. They were totally isolated and separated. But when they shined a laser light on one of these batches of neurons, instantly at the same moment, this other distant shielded batch of neurons change at the same time and in the same way. If this is not entanglement in biological terms, I don't know what else to call it. This is not a one-off experiment. This has essentially been repeated by several laboratories around the world. And so we're just going to have to shift our way of thinking. This old idea of our being totally isolated and separate from other biological creatures just doesn't work anymore. It may offend people to have to learn to think of this in a new way, but we are not cut off from other living things. This is where the new model of consciousness is headed. And I know you're fully aware of this because of your work with quantum jumping and superimposed states and all of that sort of thing. But we live in a tremendously exciting time where so many classical ideas are just being blown up and superseded. And I just think it's a terribly fascinating time to be alive. And I just want readers to know also of your work, because you've been one of the people who's been willing to take this these possibilities and actually apply them to people's daily experiences and let people run with these ideas and see how they actually have relevance in their own life.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, well, I really appreciate your leadership in this as well. I consider you one of my main mentors, so thank you. That means a lot to me. And actually, on an aside, I used to think that I sounded kind of crazy, but I ran into an old professor that I studied physics at UC Berkeley, and Professor Trilling wrote the kindest email back to me, just very appreciative of the work that I'm doing. And I wasn't expecting that, because he is a professor in quantum physics, but he's the old guard. And you know what they say about
that's great.
Yeah. But he was forward thinking, you never know. And one of your main mentors, I believe, is Lawrence Lachan. And you mentioned something he said in One Mind, which I think is really a standout observation. It's from his book, Landscapes of the Mind. And he wrote, imagine someone who says, I have no free will. Everything I do or say is determined by mechanical forces. I am a robot. And then you add, we would send him to a psychiatrist. But if a person with a PhD stands up in a lecture hall and says, all humans are mechanically determined and have no free will, we would call him a behaviorist or a psychoanalyst or a physical determinist and applaud his brilliant thinking and make him chairman of his department. Oh, I love that. So my question about this is, when we think about this, how can those of us who are open-minded about this idea of one mind, of entanglement, superposition, all these wonderful ideas, how can we converse with those who insist that consciousness exists primarily in neurons and physically measurable phenomena? Because we need to cross that bridge. That's where we're at right now.
So some of us are, we're at.
Yep.
I've been trying to come up with the proper answer to that question for about 30 or 40 years. I've probably made every mistake possible and trying to communicate with people who don't believe any of this. I'm very hopeful, however, because I have seen people who began their career as hardcore determinists who wouldn't believe any of this stuff on a bet come around because of two reasons. One is their own experiences, personal experiences, which affirms this is the way the world works. Also through pursuing models and metaphors and actual experiments in certain domains of science, which confirms what you and I are talking about. So I'm hopeful. I know that it's possible to make the transition. I think those of us like yourself and me who have spent most of our life getting comfortable with this sort of thing, let me just speak for myself. I have tended to be too aggressive in pushing these ideas. And I have found out that if one takes a backed off idea and says, look, here's the evidence, this is what I find convincing, do with it what you will, that's much more effective an approach than trying to shove data down somebody's throat who just, for constitutional reasons or whatever, are just not prepared to go there. This is not a new question that you and I face. It was faced by many of the founders of quantum mechanics back in the early part of the 1900s. And Max Planck, who ran square into this issue, the founder of quantum mechanics, said that you're not going to be able to convince everybody of the new views. He said that people will die off. Many of them will go to their graves thinking that we're crazy. And then another new generation of scientists will arise who don't think that these are strange ideas at all. And this view of Planck is often paraphrased in the view that science changes funeral by funeral. This may seem like a gruesome way to advance science, but I think there's a lot of truth there. We're not going to be able to convince every skeptic, no matter how firm the data is, that they need to come around to our way of thinking. So I think we have to be patient. We have to take the long view, historic view, and accept that logic is not going to be able to change everybody's mind.
Well, one thing I'm noticing is I'm looking into quantum logic as the necessary basis for quantum computers, and it really is different than classical logic in the sense that there is this amazing, beautiful connection between pure states, so you can go back and forth between them, and it's let's not get into all that, but it's fascinating. What I think is interesting that you're saying has to do with humanity's tendency to move toward technology. When you mentioned the wonderful experiment with the isolated neurons and that laser light shining on them, there have been similar experiments with diamonds because diamonds are being viewed as possible ingredients in the quantum computers to come, and similar research is being done with diamonds. But it seems like what humans often do is we push forward, we want the technology, just like we wanted power plants based on atomic technology, we wanted atomic nuclear weapons, but we don't seem to want to know what is behind all that. And it seems like that creates kind of a dumb and dumber scientific society. I would be hoping that we would explore the quantum paradigm itself. So I was just wondering if you have any thoughts on how we can inspire scientists, the new scientists who are listening right now, you know, the parents and the children who are thinking of moving into this area, not to get discouraged and feel like they need to get jobs with the money in the Defense Department, which was what was mostly available when I got my physics degree. Or, you know, how do you take the heart of this beautiful, beautiful information and science and make the best of it?
Well, I think one way to do it is simply to follow science where it may lead. I mean, this sounds like a stupid thing to say. Don't all scientists follow the evidence wherever it leads? And the answer is absolutely not. There are a lot of people who censor their science because of political reasons, because if they went in a certain direction, they might not get tenure, or their grant applications wouldn't get renewed. There is a tremendous difference in the level to which people are willing to pursue the implications of solid science. So following science is really important. Besides that, I think we need to be careful about high-teching our lives and forgetting our exposure to nature, to art, to music, and to one another. I recently came across absolutely sad example of this. The pollution in Beijing now is so bad that the Chinese have started videoing the sunrise. And now, since people can't see the sunrise because of pollution, they're showing the sunrise on television.
Oh, no. So that'd be funny if it wasn't so tragic.
I know. It sounds silly and a little funny, but it's tragic. So we're willing to step in with technology to try to bridge between ourselves and an experience of the natural world, in ways which I find absolutely insane. So we need to keep our feet on the ground, not only to follow science where it leads, but not to forget that we're human beings, and we need exposure to nature, to music, to art, to literature, and for God's sakes, to one another. And I think that these are two things that I would emphasize about how to stay sane and balanced in a crazy high-tech world.
And you mentioned the word God there, which I think is really wonderful, because a lot of people wonder, is the one mind God? And you actually raised that question in the book as well, one mind. So,
I raised the question because a lot of people, but some skeptics accuse me of just surreptitiously promoting religion. Not right. I don't even belong to a specific religion. But I'm not allergic to the word God, because I think people can find substitutes in terms of other ways of envisioning what is often meant by God, such as Goddess, the divine, the almighty, the absolute. Some people even have a concept of the universe that's almost indistinguishable from others' concept of the almighty. Pick your term. But the basic idea is that there's some wisdom, some pattern, some meaning in the universe that transcends the ability of human beings to get their minds around this. I feel comfortable with using the word God, but if other people don't, that's their choice.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. And we're getting toward the end, and this time has gone way too fast, but I do have a couple of other questions. One has to do with, you mentioned dream pathways in one mind, and so briefly, just in a couple minutes, if you could mention that. Everybody dreams, or most people do, and this is one of the ways, if you want to experience this one mind, that people can access.
I became interested in the connection between dreams and the one mind. And when I was writing a book on premonitions, a book called The Power of Premonitions, dreams are one of the commonest ways that people can experience unity and connectedness with other people. Dream premonitions, dreams of events that will occur in the future, which haven't displayed themselves yet, are one of the commonest ways people can access this business of the one mind. So you're apparently able in dream premonitions to see the future, even though it hasn't played itself out, and even though you cannot intuit what's going to happen from present states of knowledge. So I'm a big fan of dreams and their ability to open us up to these non-local ways of knowing.
And hopefully people, if they don't have dreams, they know just get enough sleep, actually. It sounds simple, but so many people, they stay up with their little devices, you know, their iPads and so forth, and it's better to turn that off. You know, you can actually succeed in a couple things here, reduce the technology and sleep better. And the last area, I just want to bring up one more thing, and then we can close it out. But you mentioned how one mind can help us find a potential pathway out of hell through increased compassion, provided that we aren't hijacked by narcissism and selfishness. And I know what you mean by that, but I was wondering if you could give any advice to listeners as to how to stay on track, because we can get pulled off so easily.
The best piece of advice I can give anyone is to not try too hard. I mean, people hearing us talk about these issues with this new vocabulary of non-locality, entanglement, and quantum mechanics may think that this stuff is just so complicated, I don't want anything to do with it. That would be a mistake. Accessing the one mind is one of the most simple things in our experience, because it manifests in so many different ways on so many levels. You would have to spend your life in total isolation not to bump into evidence that the one mind is the way our life works. I think just opening it up, saying, look, I'm ready to experience this. Here I am. Show me. Guide me, is probably the best way to encounter this evidence. And also setting aside some period every day, hopefully, where you can just sort of turn off your smartphone, sit down, be quiet, and just pay attention to whatever wells up from your unconsciousness. Whether you call this meditation or contemplation or just time out or alone time or whatever term fits, letting that inner wisdom, inner knowing, well up into your awareness, there's just no substitute for this. You don't have to make a big deal out of this. You don't have to call it, spiritual attunement or anything like that. Just call it paying attention and getting quiet. There's no substitute for that.
I love it. Yeah, and I actually do this practice myself. I like to take a walk each day if I can, for an hour if I've got the hour to do it, because it seems like it gives back as much as, a lot of people may think that's a lot of time. I don't have that kind of time. But it's like that old story that if you don't make that time, then you really don't have that time. So yep. Yeah, it's so wonderful. Well, thank you so much. This has been an amazing interview today. And I want to make sure that we get an opportunity, if there's anything you want to tell us about an event or anything besides this awesome book that I hope people do get a copy of, One Mind. Is there anything else you'd like to mention about your website, how to get in touch with you?
Well, it's www.larrydosseymd.com. Dossey is D-O-S-S-E-Y. LarryDosseyMD.com. I do have a little poem I'd like to leave people with.
Thank you. Yes.
Very quick. This is from Hafiz, a Persian poet from the 14th century. Let's go deeper. Go deeper. For if we do, our spirits will embrace and interweave. Our union will be so glorious that even God will not be able to tell us apart. That's the One Mind.
Wow. Thank you so much, Larry Dossey. It's been such a pleasure. I hope to have you back on another time, but thanks for now.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Living the Quantum Dream with your host, Cynthia Sue Larson of RealityShifters.com. Join Cynthia next time in visualizing and accessing whole new worlds of possibility on Evolutionary Voices for the Quantum Age. Heard Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern on the Dream Vision 7 Radio Network.